The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Question: how many of you are married or about to be married or probably will be married to a minister who may be preaching? How many of you? Could you put up your... Most of you. Yeah, okay. Either you are married to somebody who's already preaching or will be preaching someone. The main purpose, even if you're not in that category, and I think almost everybody was, even if you're not in that category, my purpose is to try to help you understand the from an outsider's point of view, not from an insider's, not telling you how to write a sermon or anything like that, but from an outsider's point of view, how to put your finger on what's good and bad about somebody's preaching, and then talk a little bit about how you can communicate that in a helpful way. And the reason for that is if you need to get wisdom in the area of listening to preaching. For example, my wife and I, my wife likes, she's not a great critic, but she likes dancing and ballet. She likes to watch it. And I like to watch basketball. Now, generally, here's what's interesting. I may be seeing watching a basketball game, and suddenly I see somebody do a round the back double windmill slam dunk, and I say to Kathy, I'll say, "Kathy, look at this. You've got to see the replay. Watch this." So, you know, she looks up from whatever she's reading, and she watches. And of course, the slow motion, this guy comes in and dives and all that. And she says, "They all do that, don't they? What's so special? I mean, they all do that." Because, see, I can look and make distinctions she can't see. I see unusual hang time. I see incredible jumping ability. And she just sees a blur. I see all these distinctions. Same thing happens when she says, "Look, watch this guy. Look, watch this girl. Watch how high they can jump. Watch the lift and all this while she's watching ballet." And I'll look and see. I'll say, "Don't they all do that?" See, I can't see distinctions. I can tell if something's really great or if something's really jerky. I can tell a real bad dancer and a really, really good dancer, but I can't make distinctions. I'm not wise in that. Just like Kathy can make out a terrible basketball player, and maybe, I'm not sure she can tell a great basketball player, she can't tell distinctions. She's not wise in that. So she's not in a position, certainly, ever, to tell a basketball player, whether or what he could do to improve. She can't tell it. She needs to develop wisdom. She probably never will, because she doesn't really need to develop that. When it comes to preaching, very often, especially since you're going to be married or are married to a preacher, you're going to be in trouble, because you're going to be faced rather constantly with a need to give evaluation and feedback. Sometimes it'll be solicited. Sometimes it'll be implicitly solicited. Sometimes right afterwards, you know, he'll turn to you and say, "What do you think? And what are you going to do?" You need to have some idea about how to listen helpfully. And that's what I... Do you all have a handout there? What I want to do is give you a fairly easy to understand, hopefully even to memorize, at least the basic features of it, way whenever you listen to somebody or something, to be able to say, "Here's what's strong, here's what's weak." Now, how to communicate that's another subject, and we'll spend a little bit of time on that too. But first of all, I want to help you to develop some wisdom in that area. All right? So, take a look here. I'm not trying to give you a whole course on how to write a sermon at all. I'm actually trying to talk about how to evaluate or assess a sermon from the outside. This is tough, though, because, see, preaching is such a mystery. In Ephesians 2, verse 17, I think it is, yeah, Paul is writing to the Ephesians there, and he says, Christ came and preached peace to you who were far away. Now, that's an amazing statement, because there's no way that the incarnate Jesus Christ, when he was on the earth, you know, in Palestine, could have possibly come to... He never did come to Ephesus and talk to these people. So what is Paul talking about? He said, Christ came and preached peace to you who are far away. It's obvious that somebody, not Jesus Christ personally, but some pastor, some minister came and preached to them. And yet Paul can say, Christ preached to you. In other words, in preaching, Christ becomes present and speaks through a frail human being. So literally that Paul can say, Christ came and preached to you. Now, that's a great mystery. That's a deep thing. And to some degree, what I'm trying to tell you is not how to define a sermon, but how to get some grip on what makes a sermon good and effective and what makes a sermon bad. Because even though it's a great mystery and we can't completely define it, still we have to be careful about not being willing to be specific at all about what makes preaching good, what makes preaching not so good. So I have here on this this handout, without trying to read you everything, especially on the first page, let me say that on the basis of my understanding of preaching and what the scripture says, you see a little triangle, a little diagram on the first page, right? Okay? Now, I would suggest to you that there's three aspects to a good sermon. There's the biblical content. In other words, does the sermon actually tell you what the text, the Bible says? Or does it impose a framework on the text? Does it actually make the text clear and really preach from the Bible? That's the first part of what makes a sermon good. Is it biblical? Then, secondly, the question is it really adapted well? Is it relevant? Is it couched and communicated in a way that's relevant and understandable to the people? See, a good sermon, it's biblical, might be a bad sermon as far as communication to the hearers. I mean, now, of course, you can say the most obvious example is that the people all understand German only and you preach in English. That's poor adaptation, right? That's not relevant. Even though your sermon is absolutely accurate, it hasn't been communicated properly. Well, it's not enough to say all you have to do is say it in German. Then the question is, what kind of German? And then what kind of concepts and what kind of illustrations do the people understand and what are their needs and so forth? So you see, the second aspect is not only does the sermon have to expound scriptural truth accurately, but it has to adapt the message to the needs and capacities of the audience. And then thirdly, you've got the personal aspect. See, it's biblical, situational, personal. And the personal aspect means that it's got to come out of a heart that is on fire. If you want to use the, maybe it's a cliche, it's got to kind of come out of a, it's got to come from a person who is clearly speaking sincerely. It's got to come from a person that there's got to be a healthy intensity. The fact is that a person can be saying the right things and saying it in the right way but to the people, but there's be something about his face, something about his personage, something about his life, which hijacks the message. Do you understand? See, for example, an extreme example would be a person who talks in a monotone, never looks up, and talks about exciting truth in a way that looks like he doesn't believe it at all. Now, in that case, everything might be right about the biblical and the situational, but the personal aspect isn't there. And the people won't believe him. They won't listen to him. It's also true that a person with this great personal intensity and winsomeness and so on can get away for a while with preaching sermons that aren't biblical and get people to follow him. But after a while, that'll catch up too. They all have to be there, the biblical, the situational, and the personal. And let me just read you a little section about this. In a sense, these three elements aren't really parts of preaching. They can't be separated, really. In fact, each element includes the others. You can't truly be biblical unless you understand the meaning and application of the text for yourself and your audience. Secondly, you can't really adapt the text unless you understand it and have applied it to yourself. And thirdly, the very personal fire that makes a preacher persuasive often comes to pass as you are expounding the word. What I mean is, what makes a minister personally powerful is that he's zealous to talk about the word because he understands it. He sees what the message is, see, because he understands the text and also because he has a deep love and concern for the needs of the people. When you put those two things together, zeal for the word and a love for the people, that's what makes them powerful. That's why I'm saying that these three aspects can't really be separated. If you really are personally powerful, you'll be biblical and situationally appropriate. If you really are situationally appropriate, it's because you understand the text and you're personally, you know, valid. And if you understand the biblical text clearly enough and radically enough, you've applied it to yourself, which gives you power, and you've applied it to the people. So the three things go together. And having said that, you may notice on the front page that I put two words underneath each situation, because what I've got there are two evaluation questions. If you turn over to the third page, that doesn't mean you can't read the whole thing sometime, but trying to be as quick as I can and expecting that there'll be time for questions, and if you want me to go back, I might cover some of these other things. But if you look here at the top of the third page, you'll see that I got six questions. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Six questions that come in under those three aspects. The biblical aspect, to find out whether the biblical perspective or aspect is in focus in a sermon, you say, is it exegetically sound? Which just means, is this sermon really telling me what the text says? Is it true to the text, you see? Is it true to what the Bible says? Is it, you know, secondly, is it clear? Can you see what the man is getting across? So is it exegetically sound, and is it structurally clear? Then look under situational. Under situational, you have to say, is the sermon insightful and vivid? Now, the reason I put that under situational is, what's vivid for one audience is totally obscure for another one. Okay? When I was in England, I made a mistake at one point of talking about a lawyer. Now, in England, you know, Sarah knows this, in England, there's barristers and there's solicitors, right? And they're different. What's a solicitor do, Sarah? A solicitor?
He doesn't.
Right, he doesn't represent at the bar. The barrister does that, from which the name comes. And in this country, you have a lawyer who does represent you in court and also can take care of legal matters without representing you in court. And so when I had a sermon on Jesus Christ as high priest. When we are with 1 John 2:1, it says, if we sin, we have an advocate with the Father. And I was talking about Jesus Christ being a lawyer. Didn't make it. I didn't realize, first of all, I knew that they didn't use the same word for lawyer. I wasn't clear on the difference between a solicitor and a barrister. I needed to say, Jesus Christ is your barrister, represents you before the bar. I wasn't insightful, I wasn't vivid, because I wasn't adapted to where the people were. I wasn't quite up with the culture at all. A big part of being insightful and vivid means to be concrete. If I talk about justification, the word means, I don't know, when I say justification, what do you think of? Do you think of any picture? Does anything come to your mind? I just think of J-U-S-T-I-F-I-C-A. You know, I just think of the word, don't you? But if I talk about Jesus Christ representing us before the bar of the justice of God, immediately that begins, you know, you begin to think of what, Perry Mason or, or something. And vividness means turning the ear into an eye. It means evoking people's senses. And that has a lot to do with where the what concrete situations the people who you're preaching to are familiar with. Then is it practical? That means the real needs and the real problems and the real questions of the people that you're preaching to, are you answering them from the Bible? Because what you want to do is take the Bible and address the people's issues, the people's questions. You don't want to answer questions people aren't asking. And that's very, very important, a very important part of what makes a sermon situationally relevant, adapted well to the audience. Now, the personal aspect, I have there's two parts to what I consider personal power and authenticity. There's warmth and there's force. I believe that temperamentally, you are either sort of sweet and approachable and nice, but not very authoritative, or else you're intense and powerful, but not very sweet and nice. Now, In our normal state, we have a tendency to be one or the other. Only the Spirit of God can really pull those things together. When that happens, everybody notices, because people aren't made like that. The great preachers could weep over people, saying, you know, showing their love, and then the next minute suddenly turn and thunder from Mount Sinai, you know, and with tremendous authority. And only when those two things are brought together, you see, the compassion and the humility and the authoritativeness and the courage, when those two things are brought together, you've got powerful preaching, you see. You've only got one or the other. One or the other ends up becoming like a smell you're in the room with so long that you can't smell it anymore, or even a sound. Ever notice the people who live near a train? When you're visiting them, the first time the train goes by, you go, "Yeah, what was that?" And they say, "Oh, we don't even notice it anymore," right? And I'll tell you, the sweetness without any light, without sunshine, without thunder, and clouds and lightning, or clouds and lightning without sunshine, eventually you just get used to it. You know, no matter how powerful the guy is, if the guy from first to last is just thundering and doing this, eventually it just puts you to sleep. Not at first, but eventually. Same thing with the sweet, warm teddy bear type of person. And only when you bring those two things together. As a matter of fact, well, we can talk more about that. That's a very hard thing to work on. Very hard. Because you can work on exegesis. You can work on audience adaptation. But you can't just go, you can't just turn to a guy and say, "You know what, you're not powerful enough." And the guy, very often when I'm teaching preaching, I'll say to a guy, I say, "You know, there's no authority, there's no thus saith the Lord about your preaching." And the guy says, "Well, what should I do? Should I use my arms more?" And I said, "That will turn you into an actor." See? "Should I speak louder?" I said, "That'll turn you into an actor." Or if the guy's comes on too strong, he said, "Well, should I smile more?" And I said, "That'll turn you into an actor, not a preacher." I said, "Well, what do I do?" It's a spiritual problem. See? In other words, when you come to happy truth, you should be happy. When you come to authoritative truth, you should be authoritative. You should let the word affect you instead of your temperament. That's not that easy. We can talk about what to do about it, but anyway, it is a spiritual matter. It has a lot to do with your goals, and maybe if you want to talk more about it, I can. So if you take a look at these six things under these three headings, here's what you've got. A sermon has to be biblical, see, exegetically sound, but a sermon can be accurate biblically and not be clear. But a sermon can be biblically accurate and clear, but not be interesting. But a sermon can be biblically sound and clear and interesting, but not really all that practical. That does not really tell me what I should do. But a sermon can be biblically sound and clear and interesting and practical, and yet not be delivered in a way that's warm and forceful. You see, a sermon is one thing. The preaching is what you're after. There are men who never give you what I would call a great sermon, but they always give you great preaching. And what that means is the sermon, just as it lays on the table, just as it would be written out, would be, okay, nice. But there's something about the person. There's a godliness. There's there's an anointing about the person who, when he takes the material that somebody else would probably just go and deliver, and everybody would say, "I already knew that." But there's some guys, because of their godliness and their zeal, are able to put that thing across and make it new. So it's not enough just to have a great sermon. There's also got to be, not only have to be biblically sound and clear and insightful and practical, but it also has to be delivered in a way that's lively. Or as one person said, sermons can't just be born, they've got to be born again. And that means it's not enough to write a good sermon. The minister actually has to discover it again as he's preaching, so that there's a surprise, there's a spontaneity, there's an excitement about it. It's got to be discovered, see? And that's what it means by being born again. Not easy. That's the hardest one of all. But, so, is it biblical, clear, interesting, practical, warm and forceful? And essentially, when I listen to somebody, I just go down those six questions, and I can always remember them, you know? And I can say, here's where you need to change. Here's where things can be better. Now, to go into a little more detail, I think I can do this in about 10 minutes. I put down here kind of pluses and negatives. Oh, wait. You notice that it says there light and heat? Just to give you an idea, light has to do with content, heat has to do with force. Sometimes the easiest way, if you can't remember, if you can't, if you're sitting and listening or something, you say, I wish I remembered that talk, I wish I had that hand, I don't remember what those six things were. If you can't remember the six, remember the three. Biblical, is it practically applicable, and is it delivered with personal power? But if you can't even remember the three, just remember this, you can't forget it, light and heat. Some preachers, accurate, clear, and cold, see? A lecture instead of a sermon. Others, passionate, but they don't really say anything. When you're all done, you say, what did I learn here? You know, lots and lots and lots of heat, but no light. Or, lots of light, but no heat. And actually, usually, if you look at different kinds of preachers, you've got Baptist preachers and Pentecostal preachers and Presbyterian preachers, you've got various kinds of preachers, you'll find that most of them have a tendency to err in one side or the other. Right? I mean, around here, as you might guess, around a Presbyterian seminary, absolutely the error would be too much light, not enough heat. You can't have too much light, but you can have too little heat. And other places, there's all this heat and no light. So if you can't remember the three, remember the two. If you can't remember the six, remember the three. All right? Anyway. Now, under these six areas, I put down here a couple of questions that might help you both positively and negatively understand something about what makes a sermon biblical and situational and personal. Like, for example, under light, I'll just read you generally the positive questions. Does the sermon explain the Bible verses themselves? Very often. There's an awful lot of good sermons that explain a lot of good biblical truths, but they have nothing to do with the text. And generally, that's not horrible. But, I mean, Jonathan Edwards did that all the time. Jonathan Edwards, one of my favorite sermons, was on this idea. It's called a sermon called The True Excellency of a Gospel Minister. And the idea in that sermon is that a good minister must be both heat and light. That's where I first got the idea. And I've never forgotten it. It's a great sermon. And it's always helping me see, you know, the balances and so on. But it was based on, it's by the way a very biblical sermon, but it's based on the text where it says John the Baptist was a burning and a shining light. And he says, see, John the Baptist had both heat and light. And you know doggone well that Jesus was not talking about that when he said John the Baptist was a burning and shining light and you rejoiced in his light for a time. And you know that's not what that verse is teaching. He's not teaching anything about how to preach. Right? But, you know, Edwards took it and he preached his whole sermon on that and it's not good. It teaches people that it doesn't really matter what the text says, you know. Well, anyway. So does the sermon really explain the Bible verses or does it go all over the place? Does the preacher stick to the Bible text and ground his sermon in the text so that the points he's making really come from the Word? If they don't, why should people believe him? You know, he should be able to say, I want you to believe this because it says so here. I want you to believe this because it says so here. His points ought to come from the Bible. Does he explain the meaning of the text or does he give a travelogue? Do you know what I mean by travelogue? People want to know what the Bible says, not how, you know, don't give me this wonderful adventure you had all week in discovering what the Bible said. First I read this book, then I read this book, then I discovered that this word really meant, that's boring, you know. And sometimes a lot of guys don't know enough about life to really preach the Bible. Instead they have to tell you how they arrived at understanding this text. And they'll tell you all, they spend a lot of time solving their own problems up in the pulpit. When the people are out there saying, I want you to solve my problems in the pulpit, not your problems. Number two, is it clear? That means there ought to be a central aim or thrust or point. If you find yourself thinking throughout the sermon, what is he getting at? Now that's all right for a few minutes, but if you find most of the way through the sermon, you're sitting there saying, now what is he trying to get me to do or believe? What is his main point? What's he driving at? If you have to stay guessing for a long time, it's not a good sermon. Because if you're guessing, the people are guessing too. One of the great advantages of black preaching is they usually, whereas generally your typical Anglo white preacher sermon has a number of points, and you can see what a good white sermon sort of looks like, a pyramid, only an upside down pyramid. It starts and makes your first point, then your second point, which is a little bit more focused, and your third point, which is a little more focused, and he draws it all together. But black preaching is more like a spiral. He says one thing, and he says it over and over again in many different ways, and he drives that point, and he drives that point. Very often he'll repeat the text, and then give some illustrations and show it from another perspective, then come back and repeat the text, and each time get louder and louder, and you never are in doubt as to what he's saying. Never. One point, and he drives it, and he drives it, and he drives it, you know, until you say, I give up. You're right, okay? But a lot of people don't do that. There just ought to be clarity about that, and there ought to be progression and proportion, too. If you find that there's a tangent being gone off, and when you're all done with the sermon, you realize the tangent wasn't the main thing he was trying to say, and yet he spent 30 minutes on it, you know, that sort of thing. Turn over to the top of page 3. Insight. Vividness. I already mentioned this, so I don't need to say. What makes a sermon insightful and vivid is that insight does not mean giving people new information. It means making the information new. Now, great example. Jonathan Edwards, a good example. There's one line, let me give you an example. There's a line in one of his sermons in which he says, it's sinners in the hands of an angry God. And in that sermon he says, your good works cannot keep you out of hell. But he doesn't stop there with a sentence, comma, any more than a spider web can hold up a falling boulder. Now, did that illustration add anything to, I mean, what if he just stopped and said, your good works cannot keep you out of hell? And he stopped there and didn't add the illustration. Would that be a less vivid point? Would it be a less terrifying point? Of course it would be. By sticking on the thing about the boulder and the spider web, suddenly he takes the truth and he doesn't give you any new information. It just, he translates it into a very concrete realm and it strikes you. And instead of it being an intellectual truth, it kind of hits you more in the heart, and that's the idea behind it. What he's doing is he is using imagination. See, imagination means to make an image. And an imaginative sermon is the most important kind of sermon possible. So the sermon's got to be vivid, creating pictures in the imagination, and so forth. One of the problems with seminary is the guys spend all their life writing papers. And papers are just content, nothing but content. They don't have to do any application, they don't have to do any illustrations, and I mean, you got to realize, I don't know how many papers you write when you're in seminary. Tremendous number of papers. Very hard at first for a guy to write sermons that aren't like papers. There's a tendency. And what I mean by a paper is that it has got no vividness to it. That's all. It's nothing but facts, lots of facts, footnotes, see, and so on. Or another way to put it is the biblical exegesis, explaining what the text says, is sort of like the skeleton of a sermon. And the illustrations and the life experiences and the examples that help you translate that into real life are like the flesh of the sermon. And all I can say is that an awful lot of guys coming out of seminary preach some extremely bony sermons. Not much flesh, you know, they're skin and bones. You know, you can see the skeleton right through the, you know, you can see the rib cage. And that's because it's not insightful or vivid. Number 4, is it practical? Boy, is it practical. I put down here, not only should the illustrations and language be suitable for the hearers, for example, your job when you're preaching a sermon is to convince the people that you've got something they need. Here's two introductions. One introduction is, we're studying Ephesians 1 this morning, and Ephesians 1 is the very best chapter in the whole Bible on the sovereignty of God, how God controls all things and works all things together according to the counsel of his will. And this is one of the great doctrines of history and so forth. And now we're going to study it. Let's take a look. That's one kind of introduction. The other kind of introduction starts like this. What have you been worrying about this week? Now think. Take a second. What have you been worrying the most about? You have been worrying, haven't you? Of course you've been worrying. What have you been worried the most about? Do you realize that the Bible has a particular truth in it that is an absolute, if you apply it properly and think about it properly, absolutely destroys worry, makes it impossible. You know what that is? It's right here in this text. It's a doctrine of the sovereignty of God. And if we understand it properly, it's going to have a tremendous effect on your own, on any problems you have with anxiety. It's going to have an immediate and relevant bearing on the thing you've worried most about this week. Let's take a look at it. Now, which of those two instructions is more interesting? Yeah, the second one. Why? Because I'm there. Just because I'm the pastor and just because I'm preaching from the Word doesn't necessarily mean that you emotionally and psychologically are going to pay attention to me unless I've convinced you I've got something you need. I've got to do that. And it doesn't mean that my sermon is going to be any less biblical. It just means that unless I have in my own mind a good idea about where the people are and I show you from the beginning, I know what you're thinking. I know what you're thinking. In fact, different times during the sermon, you've got to say, I know what some of you may be thinking at this point. You've got to carry on a dialogue, even though you don't have a dialogue. You've got to have a dialogue going, even though the people aren't actually answering you back. So the introduction and the sermon have to convince the hearers, the preacher, of something they need. The sermon cannot ignore the possibility of all sorts of people present. The sermon needs to say, needs to consider the possibility. There's people out there who are involved in secret sin, people out there who are not believers, people there who are in all kinds of situations. And another thing, there's different kinds of application where you're applying the text to people's lives. Warning, pleading, comforting, encouraging. See, they all have a different color. And there's always a tendency, it goes along with what I said about people tending to be too warm all the time or too forceful all the time. There's always a tendency to get into a rut. There's a tendency because of a man's temperament for him to tend to warn people all the time and not encourage and comfort, or comfort and encourage and not warn people. And there needs to be variety or people go to sleep. Then, warmth and force. Well, warmth has to do, I think warmth is can be broken down into a couple constituent parts. One is there's some joy. When the doctrine, when the truth is happy, why don't you get happy? See? When the sermon appears to come from the preacher's heart rather than his notes, does the sermon appear to come from the heart rather than the notes? That's really important. By the way, some people try not to preach with any notes because they want it to be from the heart. But if when you're not preaching from notes, you spend your time trying to remember it, it comes out so clear because you're just looking over. You're not really looking at anybody. You're just, you know, the guy's sitting there like that, and it's very clear that even though his notes aren't there, he's still trying to remember what he wrote down. And that kills the immediacy. Absolutely kills it. There's no sense that the guy is talking right to you. So he's got to know what he's going to say. Does the preacher evidence love and compassion for the hearers? Sometimes that is a matter of being very direct. Sometimes it's a matter of saying, look, I know what I just said sounds awfully hard. I know what I said just sounds like virtually impossible. But I want you to realize it's not impossible. It's hard to obey. I know it's hard to obey, but really, it's harder not to. It's very, very hard to obey God. And the only reason I'm calling you to do it is because I know it's even harder and more destructive to disobey Him. Now, sometimes, see, talking like that directly shows compassion. But very often, just the demeanor, you know, the face, you can't, if the audience is the enemy, and by that I mean if the audience is somebody you've got to impress so they'll come back next week, they're your enemy, and you're not going to show any compassion. Simple as that. So there's got to be, that love and compassion has got to be joy, and another part of what I mean by warmth is humility. There can't be an arrogance. There can't be, you people need to know Does the preacher seem to be feeding on the same truths he offers his hearers? Now, remember I mentioned that the only key to this warmth and force bit is not that the man says, I'll have to smile more, I'll have to use my voice more, or use my arms more, that turns you into an actor. The only thing I tell guys, they say, well, should I do this? And I say, no, that'll turn you into an actor. I say, this is what you got to do. You have got to not think so much about how you're getting across and how the people are, what the people are thinking of you and what's coming next. You have got to be able, when you tell them the truth, to actually suck on it yourself while you're feeding it to other people. I mean, a kind of crass illustration is when you're trying to feed your kid, you know, something, and he says, no. And you say, listen, it's delicious. Look. And you, hopefully you're not lying. Hopefully it is good. And then, of course, that means that you can, you, after you've tasted it and you know how wonderful it is, you're hoping that that will win over the child. It doesn't usual, but it doesn't believe you. But it's the same principle. The preacher has got to be saying, as he's preaching, if he's going to give the people something encouraging, he has to let himself be encouraged at the minute he's doing it. He's got to say, yeah, yeah, there it is, see? And it'll be clear, as the nose on my face, which is pretty clear, to anybody out there, if the minister is actually feeding on the material, or whether he's just going through the motions, or whether he's trying to remember what comes next, or whether he's just trying to get the people to think he's doing a good job. So your goal, if your goal is performance, if your goal is to do well, if your goal is to win people to think you're a good preacher, that goal will hijack the sermon. And people can tell the difference between that and a real concern for them. That's why I mean this part, this personal part, is so doggone hard to help a guy who doesn't have it. Basically, when a person says, I don't know why I'm not more warm and more animated in the pulpit, maybe I need to do this and that and this and that, I say, no, it's the other way around. You've got to forget yourself totally. You shouldn't be thinking about it. You should be thinking about the truth. You should be feeding on the truth. You should be thinking about the people's needs. You should be thinking about the Lord. And don't even think about your gestures. Don't even wonder whether you're smiling or not. That's the worst thing you can possibly do. And that's hard. That's almost like saying to somebody, don't think about elephant. Now, don't think about it. You know, that's not easy. It's quite a trick. And you have to be pretty sympathetic with anybody who's trying to do that. Under forcefulness, is it forceful? The constituent parts of forcefulness, volume is part of it, there's no doubt about it. Is it sufficient and varied enough? Forcefulness comes not just by speaking loud all the time, all the way through, that's what I mean by numbing, but a person who's able to get louder and get softer. See? Don't you remember, back before Veronica Hamill was on Hill Street Blues way back. See, I'm older than a lot of you. She used to be in these perfume commercials, and she used to start them off like this. She said, if you want someone's attention, just whisper. Do you remember those commercials? That was back before when she was just a model and not an actress yet. And there's something to that. The ability to vary your volume is very important. Again, a big part of forcefulness is the fearlessness that comes from self-forgetfulness, just not even caring anymore what people think about you. Another part of forcefulness is the directness. Do you sense the person is talking right to you? And does the preacher speak authoritatively, or does he throw out proposals? Say, well, what do you think about this? So, force. Now, is it biblical? Is it clear? Is it interesting? Is it practical? Is it warm? Is it forceful? Is there light and heat together? What if now that you've become dangerous because you know all this stuff, now you say, I now can put my finger on what he needs to change. I mean, I hope that's what is happening. You're not going to be a help unless you have some idea about that. Now what? Now what do you do with this dangerous, very dangerous information? On this last page, a couple ideas on how to help a preacher improve. Maybe you know this, maybe you don't. It If a person wants to be a pastor, it's probably not quite fair and probably not quite biblical, but the fact is that a man will be able to take criticism about almost any other part of his ministry more easily than criticism about his preaching, because he's put everything into the idea of being a preacher. I mean, everything is riding on him being competent. So when you make, if he seems to react in an awfully, awfully, awfully sensitive, touchy way, you just have to realize that you're just, you're dealing with a man's heart. Or better yet, when the Bible talks about taking a speck out of somebody's eye? Well, yeah, that's an interesting illustration. How do you take a speck out of somebody's eye? I mean, you move so slowly and so carefully. You don't say, here, do you? You don't say, well, let me look here. You can't do that. You just have to be so incredibly, incredibly slow and careful. The husband's self-image is programmed largely, how man views his preaching is going to go a long way toward how he feels about whether he's going to be worthwhile to the Lord at all and so on. But then on top of that, you're his wife. And of course, he has the same power over you at this point. You realize that the institution of marriage is built in such a way so that you have the power to challenge the accumulated verdicts that he's received from everybody or any other source all through his years. In other words, if everybody in the world says to him, you're ugly, but you say you're beautiful, he'll feel beautiful. Doesn't matter what anybody else says, really. You've got that kind of power. The institution of marriage gives you the power. On the other hand, if everybody else in the world is saying you're ugly, you're beautiful, and you're saying to him you're ugly, he'll feel ugly. Now, he's got the same power over you. You know that. It works both ways. But at this point, just realize what kind of power you've got. I mean, it's almost like this. You have taken out a speck with your fingers. But what if you had to do it, with two pliers? I mean, that's the tools you had to take a speck out of somebody's eye. It would be even harder. I mean, you'd have to be so incredibly careful because the pliers are so hard and the eye is so soft. And when you're dealing with the man's preaching, I'm just trying to say, be careful, okay? Now, having said that, doesn't mean you're not supposed to do anything. And here are a couple of interesting things. I admit, they're based on my relationship with my own wife, and everybody's relationship is a bit different. But first of all, the Ulysses principle is, remember Ulysses knew when he got near the sirens he'd go crazy. Remember, he was on the great voyage in the Odyssey, and he'd heard that when you went by the island with the sirens on them, and the women who the sirens sang this beautiful music, and anyone who heard it went mad and jumped off the boat to try to swim there and was killed on the rocks. And everybody had told Ulysses about it, so he knew it was going to happen. So what he did was he tied himself to the mast, and he put wax in the ears of all of his sailors, and he says, now when I go mad, absolutely ignore me. So he made a kind of an agreement before it happened, so everybody knew what to do. What I used to do with Kathy is I would agree, look, I know right now I want you to tell me what I do good and bad, but I also know that when you do it, I'm going to go mad. I mean, let's just say, I know I'm going to be more touchy than I ought to be, and I know I'm going to be more sensitive, and I'm going to tend to defend myself. So what I would do is I would just say, before there's a crisis or a need, you agree to give feedback, and you agree how to give feedback. You might even agree to, say, well, in two or three areas, tell me how I'm doing, A, B, C, D, or F. And that helps a whole lot better than if it's your idea to say, well, dear, I went to this little talk and about your sermon this morning. You see, that's not the right way to do it. You need to sort of have an agreement beforehand. Secondly, I suggest that the best thing to do is find out, really, is to find out before you start to give your opinion what he thought the strengths and weaknesses were, all right? Now, if you find out that he gives himself too low a grade, especially in a certain area, start by building it up. Say, no, I think it was better than that. I think you've been too hard on yourself. I really think that was good. then you can turn around and say, here's where I think there might be some needs for improvement. So what I'm putting on is, don't make your proposal till you find out what he thinks and build on that. Either add and support something you think he's right about, or and emphasize, or else, you know, correct. Now, when I said an exception, a manifestly great sermon, you don't have to say, well, what do you think? You know, go tell him if it was a manifestly great sermon. But otherwise, find out what he thinks first and build on it much, much easier. Number three, concentrate on giving feedback about delivery and the act of preaching rather than the content. The reason for that is, hopefully they'll outgrow it. I remember Roy Oliver, you know, Roy Oliver, who's in the administration here, he's about, he's in his 70s, right? Wonderful man. And he still tells jokes about back, and he came to Westminster in the 30s, and he remembers sitting down and trying to talk to his wife, and if his wife said, well, that doesn't sound like a very good idea, he basically would say, what do you know? I mean, I'm going to seminary. I've studied all these things. I've done the exegesis. You have no idea what that verse means. Now, usually the guys won't be that crass, right? They won't be that crass, but they'll think it. That's right. And there'll be a certain patronizing attitude, and it'll just be absolutely, absolutely aggravating and infuriating. Therefore, don't choose that. If you wonder whether or not he really preached the text biblically, don't choose it. Partly, that's probably the least helpful information that you can give him, because that's the only thing of all these aspects of preaching, biblical, clear, interesting, practical, warm and forceful, the only thing that a seminary works on is the first one. I mean, seminaries basically spend 99% of all the time the guys are here to make sure that their sermons are biblical, and it leaves everything else just assumes that they know what to do in the other areas, and they don't. So it's really the one area where you know, don't pick a fight with them about that, or else make sure you've read up before you do. And the last thing is, Kathy and I had some signals. After a number of weeks and months went by, and I realized that I constantly would talk too fast. You can see it already now. I mean, this is 15 years later. I still can talk too fast. Kathy just had a couple of, we just worked out a signal, because I discovered that I could not catch myself. I just couldn't. So Kathy used to pull in her hair like that. And that meant, because she used to twirl her hair anyway. She's just very careful never to twirl her hair. Occasionally, she would forget. Since she would twirl her hair, she doesn't have long hair, but she used to have real long hair. And occasionally, she would just forget and twirl it. And everything would be fine about it. It would just, I would say, I can't be going too fast. So then I would slow way down. Afterwards, Kathy said, why did you drag it there? That didn't happen too often. But anyway, if for one or two very clearly agreed upon besetting sins like talking too fast, it's not too bad. But actually, the very best feedback you can give a person while he's preaching is an open facial expression, you know, just a willingness to look open and supportive, because, boy, sometimes a guy is out there just desperate for an affirming face. A lot of people, even people who really liked my preaching and grew from my preaching the best, just because of the way they were, they would listen with a kind of angry look on their face. I had one elder that always listened to sermons like this. Just like that. You know, it took me a year to figure out he loved the preaching. I thought, man, this man will be ready to, from there, he must want my head, you know. So actually the nicest thing is simply an open, affirming face. Now, having said all that, what would you like me to go back over? Anything you want me to elaborate on? Any other kinds of questions? This is important, and you're not going to be able to avoid this if you're married to somebody who preaches regularly. You're not going to be able to avoid it. You are going to have to talk about it. Yeah. You mean in the preparation? Yeah. Maybe it's not as easy, because I found that whereas Kathy is at this point, I don't even like to preach or speak without her being there, because when she comes back, I come back if she wasn't there and she says, how did it go? I said, I don't know, you weren't there. I really feel like that, because she knows me so well. She can tell me whether I, you know, what I did right and wrong. But even now, if I tell her I'm thinking of saying this or that in the preparation of it, even now she'll say, oh, that's a bad idea, or that's a great idea. And later on she'll realize, she said, that's not what I thought you meant. When she hears it, she says, that's not what I thought you meant. It's very hard when you just tell somebody, here's what I'm thinking about preaching about, and here's what I think I want to talk about, to give them the whole picture. And so in general, I discovered, this is personal, see, I discovered that if I ran preaching ideas before her in my preparation, it generally, we just went around in circles, got confused. She said, well, I don't know whether that'll go over very well. And I said, I think it's exactly what people need. And it happened so often that she didn't like what I was preparing, but then loved the sermon, that I finally decided, I'm not communicating it right when I'm talking about it. And we just pretty much stay out of it. I don't talk to her at all about it, hardly at all. What I will do is say, I will call her up or talk to her and say, if you were preaching on this yourself, what would you say? If you were trying to appeal to somebody like this, what would you say? So I get lots of ideas from her, but I don't tell her my ideas. Don't ask me why. It just hasn't worked. But that doesn't mean it wouldn't work with you. So my answer is, we just found we got into too many tussles. Now that I'm more confident about my ability to preach, I'm not quite as scared about it. I used to run everything by her, and I mean, my preparation. After about a year of preaching, I used to call a friend of mine up in Massachusetts that I went to college with, David Midwood. We found out after about 6 to 8 months, we were both in our ministry, we found out that every Saturday night we were up on the toilet with diarrhea. 2 o'clock in the morning. That scared both of us. I'd say it took me 2 years to get over that. And I also would sit around and I just could not figure out. You know, you over-prepare because you want it to be perfect. And at times like that, I think the best thing Kathy could possibly do is to just be supportive and not try to give. During preparation is a really bad time. You know, if you're working and working and working, and it's 1 o'clock the night before, you know, Sunday morning, and she says, are you going to come to bed? And I say, well, I'm working on this. I want to say this and this and this and this. And if she says, I don't know whether that sounds like such a great idea, I'm just ready to kill myself at that point, just throw myself out the window. So the best thing she could do during preparation is just be real warm, real supportive, real affirming of just about anything. And after the sermon, after she really saw the finished product, then we could talk about this, and that's how she helped me this. So by the way, if your husband stays up real late and doesn't look like he's spending enough time preparing beforehand and looks like his life is out of control and he's scared to death, he's probably just normal. In the early stage, you know why? If you preach 4 sermons in your life, you know, and this is the 5th sermon, I mean, you know, it's like 20% of your whole life is riding on this sermon. It's after you've preached 1,000 times, you say, well, I get out there and I pray the Lord will bring revival, but if he doesn't, maybe the next time. But not in the early stages. Everyone is the end of the world, just about. So, Colleen?
Yeah.
Well, it can't be done immediately. What do you mean?
Well, it's like if I tell him that smile, he just tenses up. Like,
yeah. Yeah, there is no way to forget yourself early on. There isn't. Anymore, when you're first learning to drive, I mean, now, if you've been driving a long time and you're driving with a stick shift, right, do you think every time you put your left foot down on the clutch and, I mean, you don't say, okay, left foot down. You don't do that. You just do it habitually. In the beginning, it's completely self-conscious. There's no way around it at first. You just have to let the guy know that that's the ultimate goal, and you have to realize that early on when you haven't done it a whole lot, there's almost no way to completely do that. Actually, the best way is the guy's got to have time for lots of prayer during the week. He's got to have a great devotional life. He's got to happen. It's the only possible way to combat it. So that's why I said it's really a spiritual issue. It's not a matter of great public speaking coaching and stuff like that. He's got to have that. And then eventually it'll wear off. By the way, because so many guys now say, maybe they're right, they say, I want a multiple staff position. I don't want to take a church when I get out of seminary. I want to be assistant pastor or something. That's all right, but they don't preach as much. And very often, 5, 6, 7 years, from now, they may still be on the toilet, you know, 2 a.m, because they just haven't preached enough to really get into the groove. I'm very glad. I had only preached 2 sermons in my life. Each time it took me 2 weeks to prepare for each sermon. I mean, I preached it my senior year in seminary. I preached twice, and each time it took me 2 weeks to write the sermons. And I went to a church that I had to preach 3 times a week in right away, you know, Sunday morning, Sunday evening, Wednesday night. Small church, about 90 people. And I sat down and I said, okay, let me figure out how much time I'll be taking in preparation now. If it takes me 2 weeks to write a sermon, and I have to preach 3 times a week, now 2 weeks into 3 weeks, no, 2 weeks into 1 week, and I said, this won't work. So there's some advantages to the trial by fire, or finding a place where you can just preach regularly, even if it's to, even if it's to 6 old ladies, you know, in some little country charge someplace. If you can get out, it's good if you can. So, other hands, other. Sarah? Yeah. Sure. Yeah.
But they don't have any application with preachers. And people who search and say, oh, Lord, the Holy Spirit will require me during the week. Quiet when.
Right. Well, are you saying preachers that are well received and people are edified, but they don't do any practical application? I mean, can you think of anybody I would know? Do you mind my asking?
Maybe no, I don't know.
Yeah. Right. Right. Well. That's right. Well, look, to some degree, some of that is a matter of gifts. I really do believe that your gifts affect the kind of preaching you do. And there are teachy preachers. That is, there's preaching that has a high component of teaching and instruction, and it will meet the needs of certain kinds of people, and maybe not other kinds. So I don't want to go, since I'm not exactly, I don't have this example in front of me, I'm not sure I want to go so far as to say it's always got to have practical application in it. But in general, I don't know how you can actually, look at it this way, you can't preach the Bible without answering questions. And even a person that doesn't look like he's doing practical application, he is answering questions. Now the questions, if it seems like a heady sermon, what it means is he's answering questions that fairly well-educated Christians who are asking a lot of intellectual questions about the text are asking. So practical application just means answer the questions from the Bible that people are asking. So there's no such thing in that sense of being a sermon that's not oriented toward people. The question is the sermon oriented toward a good cross-section of people? Is it really dealing with all the kinds of questions? And usually intellectual heady sermons really minister to some people, but it's usually a fairly mature, exclusive, elite group of people. That's what I usually find out. So very often people that preach like that have small, extremely disciplined, mature, loyal congregations, but very small, because there's just not that many people asking the questions that man's answering. For example, remember those two introductions I gave you about the sovereignty of God? I think the second one is more interesting to more people. The first one would probably be all that's necessary for some people that are already fairly literate in the Bible and would like to hear. You know, they say, yes, I really don't have down a good grasp of the sovereignty of God. I want to hear about it. See, that's a question. Most people are struggling with different questions. So I think it's really a matter of make sure your sermon meets a broad variety of questions. Maybe that's the best way I could answer it. Other, yes, Trish.
I've got a comment.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm glad. You see, I couldn't handle that. I couldn't handle the weight. I needed to have it on Sunday. Good. Now that shows. I'll tell you something. That shows a certain amount of security that he could not even ask and say, "We'll talk about it tomorrow." I didn't have that much in the early days. I needed to know right away. I just couldn't. I couldn't live with it. I remember thinking about that, saying, "Look." Actually, Kathy did say, "Let's at least wait till we get home." But that's right. Ruin lunch. But I remember thinking, let's just wait until Monday to sit down and really work it over. And in general, that would have been good. But I was too nervous. I wanted to know, what did you think? And Kathy used to beg me to wait until the next, till Monday or Tuesday or later on. So actually, that's a pretty good idea if you both agree to it. Right. You said it. Very helpful. That's a good insight. Right. That's right. Great. Tremendous danger. The second is harder than the first. The hardest thing is for preachers to be edified by other preachers. I mean, if preachers were really honest, they would admit that they are comparing themselves to everybody they hear. And that's really dangerous. Very, very bad. And it takes a spiritual discipline to not do that, but to say, I need to hear this now. And I think it just takes, I think, the same thing with the wife. I think the wife has to say, Lord, you know, speak to me through this. And try, actually, you know what I usually, what I have to do when I read a devotional book, if I read almost anything, I immediately say, that'll preach. I could use that. And I have now habitually gotten to the place where when I say that, I say, wait a minute. Let me think about why. Do I need that? Let me humble myself. Let me think about, let me examine myself. You can do that. You can through a discipline, make yourself say, where do I miss this? Where do I need to practice this next? And you have to do this in front of God. You have to talk to God and pray about it and say, Lord, I do need to hear that. You have to work at it, because maybe right now you don't have to work at it yet, but after you've been the wife of a pastor long enough, you will have to start working at it, just like I do. When I listen to a sermon or read a book, I have to force myself to let it preach to me before I analyze it. And you're going to have to do the same thing. I actually have to stop myself again and again. Every day, I read, right now, for my devotional reading in the morning, I'm reading William Gurnall's The Christian in Complete Armor. Great book. And virtually every day, I have to force myself not to say, boy, that would be a great illustration, and start writing and thinking about how that would go, or what sermon series that would fit into. The real hard thing is going to be if your marriage relationship isn't pristine. You see, if you're listening to a man preach, and you know that he's not, you know that he's got great gaping holes in his Christian walk. I mean, if you've ever got a pastor that you realize that he's cruel, or that he gossips, or that he tells secrets and things like that, it doesn't matter how great that sermon is, he's lost credibility, and it just doesn't hit you in the heart. Now, what happens is if you and your husband are not getting along in some way, you might as well stay. You better just stay away from sermon criticism, because you're going to find all kinds of faults that maybe aren't even there. You're going to be too harsh on him. Not only that, but you know, it's worse than that. Is he won't be able to minister to you at all. His sermons won't minister to you. Nothing. You'll be without a pastor. I mean, again and again, I've seen pastors whose marriages are on shaky ground. One of the worst things that happens is the wife is completely without any spiritual pastoring or ministration at all. And unfortunately, maybe this is wrong, I as a pastor, before I was a pastor, I could go days without really being close to God and not have to be a hypocrite about it. Now, every day when I'm a pastor, I've got to tell people how great God is. And unless I believe God is great, I'm being a hypocrite and I'm hardening myself. So when I became a pastor, I found that it pushed me to have to get things right with God almost on the hour. Or else I started putting on this ministerial front. While inside I really was far away from it, I put on this front and started talking to people about how great the Lord was. And I said, man, this is going to turn me into a Pharisee so fast. And so being in the ministry meant that I couldn't let my relationship with God go. But it's the same way with my wife. I think that if I was in some other profession, I could, you know, let it ride and say, oh, she'll get over it, you know, that kind of thing. It'll right itself. You know, I don't have to go and reconcile with her, but I can't do that as a pastor. I can't. And I have to let it, I've got to get the marriage thing, I've got to get to keep the marriage relationship clean and healthy. And let me tell you, if your relationship isn't good, there's two places that it'll show up pretty quickly. One is in bed, and the other is in talking about his sermons. I mean, unless the relationship is really good, the friction will show up there, and the problems will show up there. So, how nice, isn't it? Look, being a pastor will make you, married to a pastor will make your marriage far better or far worse than it would have been otherwise if you'd married somebody who's had another kind of job. It has a polarizing effect. Do you understand that? It's either going to push you on to greater heights than you ever would have had otherwise if you'd just gone and become an engineer, or else it's going to push it way down and make it a much more difficult relationship. So anyway, any other questions? I know I'm going a little longer than I wanted, but these are great questions. Maybe you don't want any more answers. Some of you are looking and saying, I don't want it. This isn't bad news, really, friends. It really isn't. Yeah. If you wave your hands too much, I'll tell you something. It's much easier to work on cutting down on something. If I use my hands too much, it's all right to say, you know, hold your hands down, don't use them as much. That's all right. That doesn't create artificiality. On the other hand, if you tend to be like this anyway, to ask a guy to start using his hands, I think can create artificiality. But to cut down a person who talks too fast, to say a few less words per minute, for a guy who's using his hands too much, to say, hey, you know, hold on to the podium a little bit, be a little bit less antsy up there. That's all right. That's all right. But, you know, if a person's godly, and the sermon is really from the Word and from the heart and to the heart, then frankly, whether you use your hands too much, I use my hands too much, I know that. In fact, when I see myself on videotape, I do an awful lot of things that all the speech books say I shouldn't do. An awful lot of things. And I know I'm not ready for prime time in many ways. But I'm so glad I didn't try to comb all those things out. It would have made me very self-conscious, even worse than I was. So, yes. So my mother was Italian, my father was German. So I can either talk or listen, you know. And father was very, very, very stone-faced. My mother used her hands and was very, very demonstrative. And was very, my wife says, here's what you are. She says, out of the pulpit, you're German, and in the pulpit, you're Italian. And so I use my hands.